Welcome to Out With Dan, the podcast that spotlights and examines the voices of LGBTQ+ authors, characters, and our allies. Together, we lift our voices and we tell our stories. I'm Dan White. Join me as I chat with this week's author. Hello, and welcome back to Out With Dan. Today, I'm excited to talk to Kemper Donovan about The Busybody. Welcome, Kemper.
Thank you for having me. I'm so thrilled to be here.
Oh, thank you so much. What a fun book. I had such a good time. So I'm going to ask you some things all over the map just to torture you. So,
okay.
This book is very women strong. Was that intentional?
It was. Yeah. I mean, it features a female sort of detective sidekick duo. One of those women is the first person narrator of the story, right? So it absolutely is very woman heavy. And I've had people ask me, why did you do that? And I can't say that I ever made a conscious decision. It's just what felt right to me. And I hope that, you know, there's some authenticity there, despite the fact that I am in fact a man. Those were the characters that I wanted to write.
Well, and I do like it. I am a big supporter of women's rights, and I love it when women are portrayed as strong protagonists. And that's something that you've given us, and I do like that. So it's also set in Maine. Is there a particular reason for Maine?
Well, the detective character in this book, the amateur sleuth, is named Dorothy Gibson, and she is based on a few real world analogs. The most obvious one is Hillary Clinton, but a less obvious one is the Maine Senator Margaret Chase Smith, who's a really fascinating politician from the 20th century. She entered U.S. politics by way of this phenomenon known as widow's mandate. And I gave this backstory to Dorothy Gibson in my book. Basically, Margaret Chase Smith's husband was a U.S. representative. He passed away and she filled his seat. And this is something that happened in the early 20th century. The party used them as placeholders until a more suitable replacement could be found. And of course, by suitable, they meant male. But some of these women didn't go away, and they embarked on really productive and, just very wonderful careers of their own. And Margaret Chase Smith is a great example of that. So she ended up being a U.S. representative and then a senator for decades and decades and decades, and had this sort of centrist kind of a spirit. She was a Republican, but she would reach across the aisle very often. And she's probably most famous now for delivering a speech on the floor of the Senate known as the Declaration of Conscience, which was a denunciation of McCarthyism. And she did that all the way back in the early 50s. And it was this big moment. So there's a lot of Margaret Chase Smith in Dorothy Gibson, and in that she is from Maine and has that kind of Maine independent streak to her. It felt right that Dorothy should be in Maine. And then, of course, the woods of Maine is a great setting for a murder mystery, especially in the winter or close to the winter. So.
It is. And I also have been to England a few times, and some days it's really, really gray. And the last time I was in Maine, it was really, really gray. And they're so similar in that. And the fact that also England's a little higher up than, say, we are here in LA. So it is much more gray and colder. So I love that. And I do know that you're an Agatha Christie fan, just as I am. You have a podcast about Agatha. Is that correct?
That's right. My podcast is called All About Agatha, and I've been doing it for 7 years. It started as a joint venture. My good friend Catherine Brobeck and I were always mystery nerds together, and we would talk about how much we loved the David Suchet, Agatha Christie's Poirot series, for instance, and just Agatha Christie in general. So back in 2016, we started this podcast together, and there it had kind of an overarching structure, which was to rank every single full-length mystery novel that Agatha Christie wrote. So that is 66 novels. And we actually broke down each novel. We reread them in publication order, and we broke down our analysis into six different categories, plot mechanics, plot credibility, book specific characters, series long characters, setting and tone, and then something called deductions for something called depictions stuck in their time, which is a little bit the phenomenon of reading Agatha Christie now, and sometimes feeling like there's a jarring moment that perhaps wasn't intended when Christie was writing. And this is what happens when you write a book, you know, from the 20s and people are still reading it 100 years later. It's the ultimate compliment, I think, that sometimes we're surprised when we read Agatha Christie by the way intimate aspects of humanity are depicted. But I think it's also something that you do have to grapple with when you're reading books from long ago and when people read Christie. So we felt that we couldn't ignore that aspect, but it really is part of the celebration of Christie. And I do just have to mention, Catherine tragically passed away at the end of 2021.
Oh, I'm sorry, Cooper.
Yeah. So I now do the podcast on my own. I've been doing it on my own for over 2 years now, which is crazy. And we had 6 books to go before
the
project. But I mean, the silver lining to come out of this tragedy is that many of the friends that Catherine and I made within the Agatha Christie community of scholars and devotees really stepped up and helped me rank those last 6 books. And the final book, I actually had Catherine's mother come on, and we did that one together. And it's, you know, probably the episode I'm most proud of that I ever did, although it was the hardest episode I ever did. So the pod, it just became something different, and I'm just continuing on with it because there's no dearth of material where Agatha Christie is concerned. There's always a new movie or a new biography or a new book, because there are even continuation novels and short stories being made. And pretty much every mystery author, I think, was influenced in some way by Agatha Christie. So I like having conversations just like we're having right now with mystery authors about how Agatha Christie might have influenced them. And so I hope to be doing that forever.
So are you Team Marple or Team Poirot?
That is literally the question that I ask at the end of any interview I do. So this is, I feel very much at home here, Dan. This is great.
Come on,
Kimber. I am Team Marple all the way. I'm all about Miss Marple. Yeah, a total Marpleite. It would worked really well because Catherine was a Poirotian.
Oh.
And many people are. And you know what? I mean, that's such a defensible position, too. I mean, so many of her sort of like most high profile novels, the ones with the trickiest, most clever puzzles, are Poirot. She had this run in the 30s where she did, I believe it was 9 Poirots in a row.
Wow.
And Miss Marple really doesn't come until later on. You know, she did one like, you know, in 1930, but then she kind of took a break anyway. So there are a lot more Poirots. But yes, my heart is with Miss Marple.
Mine is as well. I grew up in a small village, and it was not St. Mary Mead, but I will say that the things that Christie does with Marple is she shows the humanity of local life. And I really, really, in my life, because I read Christie early on, I sort of felt like I was a Marple even when I was younger, because I would notice similarities in people. And I'm like, oh, I sort of know what your story is. So...
Absolutely. One of my, I mean, I, at this point, I've talked about Christie so much with so many people that I've been able to, I think, develop some interesting theories about why Christie is just as, you know, successful of an author as she is, and why she continues to bring in new readers. And one really interesting theory having to do with Miss Marple specifically, it's not mine. It comes from a guest I've had on twice now. Her name is Sarah Hinlicky Wilson, and she's actually a Lutheran pastor. But she's also very much a literary scholar and a writer herself. And there's this whole notion of low anthropology, which is the idea that if we're honest about humanity, we do a lot of bad stuff. Like people are, you know, not at their core bad per se, but there's a lot of evil in the world. There are a lot of bad things that happen. And if we're honest about that, it sort of allows us to then have empathy for people. And it can sort of be like the bedrock of our faith. And that's basically what Miss Marple does. I mean, it's so interesting how she is so clued into just how terrible people are. And she's so cynical, and she always thinks the worst of people. And yet she's a woman of faith.
Yes.
It's this interesting dichotomy that she holds in herself. And I find it really powerful. Like I kind of, you know, use Miss Marple almost as a model for me in my life. And I think these are the kinds of things that you can get out of Agatha Christie, especially when you revisit her as an adult and when you read closely and you know, you give her that sort of scholarly attention that many other authors, male authors, get so easily. That's why this podcast has been such a joy, just being able to do that myself and speak with other people who do that. And I just feel like every time I do an episode, it enriches my experience of Christie's texts.
Well, and I'm going to share a little thing that I will share with you via email, but I may not be able to the entire audience, but if you want it, send me an email and I'll send it to you. Catherine Shellman who's an author, did this little study of the gay characters in Christie's books. Mm-hmm. And I was, you know, in reading the compilation, I was like, I knew this one, but I had to look at a lot of other characters really quite differently. You know, that's something that I feel like Christie was so far ahead of her time in, the fact that she represented all of humanity, not just what we talked about before. I feel like Christie was always in the rich set, but you have a different philosophy that she was more in the middle class set. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, so I know that sometimes Christie is pigeonholed as writing about lords and ladies in, you know, on big country estates. But when you actually look at the text, you know, she really was writing about the middle classes to a large extent. People who were definitely had money, but were not necessarily in the landed gentry. I think if you compare her with an author like Dorothy Sayers, for example, whose detective was Lord Peter Wimsey, a lot of those books are taking place in really, you know, the upper echelons of society. Christie is a lot more in the middle, and she herself even was, believe it or not, part of the middle class, even though she was born, you know, on this estate in Torquay with multiple servants. But when in 1890, believe it or not, that kind of was being middle class at that point. So I think part of it is there's a little bit of a cultural misconception, especially coming from an American perspective, what it means to be middle class in 21st century in the 21st century United States is not at all what it meant to be quote unquote middle class in the mid 20th century in the UK. So I think there's that we kind of have to filter through. But when you look at the text, she really is often dealing with people who are striving. They're striving to become perhaps a little bit more upper class, or just to be on the upper end of the middle class in which they are. And they're worried about falling down into the lower end of the middle class, or perhaps even into more of a working class situation. She does occasionally write about working class people, and she does occasionally write about truly upper class, more aristocratic characters. She absolutely does. But I think the bulk of what she does really is in the middle. And it's that in that fluidity and that anxiety over, you know, being fluid in the wrong direction. She gets a lot out of that in terms of motivations for murder and just sort of general hijinks and mayhem. So,
well, and I think that also influences your book as well, because, you know, the ghostwriter is always chasing the next story, hoping to be as good as the last one, and maybe this one's better than the last one. And I think that's a fear we all have in life. I think, sadly, you're going to have it on your next book that you write. Yeah. So I wonder if, so I was struck by the fact that I thought your ghostwriter reminded me some of Lucy Islesboro from What Mrs. McGillicuddy Saw. Do you feel that that's a fair assessment?
Oh, that's so funny. I love Lucy Islesboro. She is one of my favorite minor characters.
Mine as well.
Actually. Yeah. Yeah. From 450 from Paddington / What Mrs. McGillicuddy Saw, to use the American. Not many people use the American title. I like that you referenced it that way, with an exclamation point too.
Yes. What Mrs.
McGillicuddy Saw.
That's right.
Because it is very surprising what she saw. No spoiler, because it happens at the very beginning. She sees someone getting strangled to death.
Precisely.
Yeah, I love that. And I think that is actually a fair assessment, because Lucy Islesboro is someone who is also on the margins. She's chosen to be there. And I mean, and that's sort of the, I think that's the key characteristic for any amateur sleuth, especially, that they be somehow on the margins. You know, yes. Poirot, for example, he's a war refugee. He's a refugee from Belgium when he's first introduced in The Mysterious Affair at Styles, which is just after World War I. Miss Marple, even though she's very much a part of her society within St. Mary Mead. She certainly has a place there. You could make an argument that she's one of these quote unquote surplus women. After the First World War, there was, you know, there were all of these single unmarried women, and it was a little bit, what do we do with these women? You know, where do they go? What role do they serve? Since she doesn't have a family of her own, she did not get married. So in that way, she's perhaps a little bit marginalized. And my ghostwriter character is definitely someone who I think marginalizes herself. Yes. You know, she's a writer, and writers often do that because you can, the, you know, the best place to observe is from the edges, right? And I think Lucy Islesborough has made a career out of that, because that's what's so interesting about her, that she chooses not to stay in one place for very long. And she sort of does different things. And then she takes these long holidays, right? And she just wants to enjoy her life as much as possible. So that unique, I think, perspective on, you know, what it means to be a person in the world and kind of cordoning yourself off. Absolutely. I think they share that characteristic.
Well, I'm glad you sort of see it the same way I do, because you know, I mean, it sort of gives me a little bit of vindication, just a little bit anyway. So one thing you do with one of your characters named Denny is you bring us a beauty into the book, which I love. I love the continual descriptions of Denny and how the ghostwriter and also Dorothy, they see Denny. And there's a moment in the book that Denny gets a little hurt feeling, because he says, I feel like all you see me as is a visual object. Mm-hmm. And the one thing I liked about that is I've known quite a few beauty queens in my life, real, actual, everyday beauty queens. Mm-hmm. And some of them have been very, very smart. And there they are caught between the dichotomy of being beautiful and being smart. And I love the fact that you gave Denny that little bit of a voice there to remind us all that we're visual creatures, those of us who are sighted, and we do judge books by the cover. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, we also want to be respected. And I love that you included that. I felt like it was the right thing to do.
Oh, I appreciate that. Yeah. Beauty and brains. You can have it both. You can have it all. And yet Denny is the sort of, you know, one of the bodyguards, right? For Dorothy Gibson, who is this former senator. So he's part of her security detail, and a quasi romance develops between him and the ghostwriter. And she definitely, there's a lot of objectification that's happening there. And I did think it was important to give him a voice and to air that perspective that he's not just an object, obviously, because he's a human being. And, you know, perhaps we'll see more from him in future books. Perhaps not, but we shall see.
Which I just thought it was such a nice thing, because it was a nice homage to what women often have to encounter, sadly, at work and at home in different places, if you're pretty. I mean, it's just something. And I do want to quote something from the book, and this isn't just about his beauty, but it's something that the ghostwriter says: the expectation is nowhere near as good as the reality. I was like, all right, now go ahead. I like that.
Yes. No, I think it is important. I mean, this is a book that is very focused, you know, and I think all mysteries, just like all books, you know, you have your surface plot, but then there are thematic preoccupations underlying the plot. And I think sometimes people assume that in a mystery, all that's happening is whodunit, right? And that's just, it's not the case in good mysteries. It's certainly not the case in Agatha Christie. There's so much going on underneath the surface. And here, there's a real, I think, preoccupation with gender and sort of, you know, the role of women in politics, in these investigations. That's kind of the analogous story that's playing out here, as these two women are investigating in an unofficial capacity. And there are two parallel male police officers who are doing not necessarily such a great job in parallel with them. And they're slightly comedic as well. And I think that point about objectification goes hand in hand. I think it's important in this book to have objectification occur, because that is something that occurs, but also to push back on it at key moments, and not to have the objectification be on the women. That's not something that I really wanted to do, because it didn't feel appropriate for this book, I guess, given who I am, given what I wanted to do. But I'm glad that it is in there.
I love it. And talking about not judging a book by the cover, so I'm going to hold this up again. I love this cover. Who designed it?
So my publisher, they need to take all of the credit for it, and I will give them all of the credit because they asked me, you know, what do you want to do for the cover? And the only guidance I gave them was, I don't want the cover to be too busy, like no pun intended.
Right.
But I think that there are a lot of covers nowadays that just have a lot of writing splashed on them. You know, the title takes up almost the entire cover and then the author's name. So it feels very writing heavy and not object heavy. And I said, I like the books by Anthony Horowitz and Richard Osman. They have come out with some very popular, similarly puzzle-ish mysteries in the last couple of years. And those covers tend to have one sort of object on them and not much else. So I said, I'd love something like that. And then that is what I got back, almost exactly like that. And it's just gorgeous.
It is absolutely gorgeous, and it is very eye-stunning. You were the number one pick at Vroman's in Pasadena a few weeks ago when I was there, and I was just blown away by the cover. I'm like, oh my heavens, I love this.
Yeah, it's really all of the negative space, I think, really draws in the eye because that's unusual, and the fact that it's black, and then you have, you know, that wonderfully sassy sort of like shushing silhouette of a busybody. And then what I really love are all the writerly aspects, because my narrator is a ghostwriter. She talks a lot about writing. You know, that's something else that I think is sort of a, you know, write what you know. And I definitely sit around thinking a lot about the writing process. So there's some of that in there. And obviously we have the pen, and then also the font is typewriter font. So just all those little touches really bring it together. They did such a great job.
And
so shout out to Kensington,
right? A drip of blood, or at least red ink, one of the other. So that it's a lovely touch. So will Dorothy or the ghostwriter be back?
So this is my spin. When I sold The Busybody, I sold it as the first of a 3-book series. So there are two more books guaranteed. And if I'm lucky, maybe more than that. Here's my little spin on the genre, which usually involves a detective sidekick duo, right? Traveling from book to book, something like Poirot, Hastings, or Sherlock Holmes, John Watson, sort of a deal. So what I'm doing is creating a sidekick series. So it is only the ghostwriter who is going to travel from book to book. She will always be narrating the books and quote unquote writing them. And in each fresh setting, she will also pair up with a fresh detective.
So it's as though
we're following around a Watson or a Hastings, except that my sidekick character is a lot smarter and I think snazzier than that, because you need the character to be that way if she's going to be the connective tissue. But that also is a challenge, because you can't have your narrator be too smart or perceptive in a mystery, because then obviously there would be no mystery. So her intelligence isn't necessarily in deductive reasoning and sleuthing on the spot, but she brings a lot, I think, in terms of her storytelling. And
she will be sidekicking it through at least three books. I love it.
Exactly.
Did you have a favorite character to write?
She was probably my favorite character to write. I definitely really fell in love with who she is and what her voice is. And since it is from the first person, we're really only in her voice, though obviously, you know, we have scenes, we have lots of dialogue, you know, between her and other characters. I would have to say her, but I enjoyed writing everyone. You know, you have to, I think in a mystery, there are, you know, you have your cast of suspects, you have your victims. And these are the ways that Catherine and I would break down Agatha Christie's novels. And I really broke down my own novel the same way. And you have to make sure that each of them brings something to the table and is interesting for some reason. Otherwise, they really shouldn't be there. You can't just have filler. So I really loved all of them.
I love it. I absolutely love it. So do you have a website or a social media you would like to share?
I do. I should say that the All About Agatha podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts. If you just put All About Agatha or even Agatha Christie into the search engine, it should pop up. So there's a wonderful little Art Deco artwork there that I have for the podcast. And so I encourage anyone who's interested in Agatha Christie or mystery to check that out. I have a website, an author website, which is KemperDonovan.com. And I actually have some book tour dates coming up. I'll be touring in April in the Northeast and Midwest. of the United States. So I'll be all over the place. And I've got all the details there on my website. And I'm on Twitter at All About The Dame and on Instagram at All About Agatha. And you could also find me on Facebook at Kemper Donovan Books.
Perfect. Thank you so much. Hang on for me just a second. Now I'm going to go into the second thing. Kemper Donovan, what you reading?
So I know I should be saying I'm reading a mystery right now, but you know what? I'm going to give you the real answer of what I'm really reading, what is really on my nightstand right now. And that is Dune.
Okay.
Frank Herbert's Dune, because Frank Herbert really needs the shout out, right? You know, his stuff is doing okay, but I've always been obsessed with the process of adaptation. So I love reading a book, especially if I know that it's being adapted in a big splashy way. And I've been meaning to read Dune for decades. And finally, the second movie, you know, Dune Part Two is in theaters now. I was like, I have to see it while it's in the theater. So I am racing through Dune by Frank Herbert. And I will be in a theater very soon with a big bucket of popcorn, enjoying Timothée Chalamet and Zendaya and everyone else in that movie.
Perfect. I absolutely love it. Well, thanks for the shout out for Dune. Hang on for me just a second.
Okay.
Thank you for joining me for this week's episode of Out with Dan. You can find more information about this podcast and its host at outwithdan.com, on Twitter at @outwithdan, and on Instagram and Facebook at @GoOutWithDan. This podcast is hosted by Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, and the theme music is provided by bensound.com. Join us again soon for the next episode of Out with Dan.